Hey, everybody. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie. I'm your host, Norm Wilner, and as you know, every episode is the same. A one-on-one interview with a filmmaker, film critic, actor, or industry watcher about one specific movie they want people to rediscover. Can't be a film they were involved with, just one they want to put back into the conversation. This episode, we're doing John Frankenheimer's 1998 thriller Ronin, the one where Robert De Niro, Jean Reno, Stellan Skarsgård, and Sean Bean play an elite team of mercenaries, unknown to one another, who come together in France for a job of work stealing an invaluable case. What's in the case? Well, that's one of several elements the movie will enjoy withholding from you, the better to ramp up the tension while steering us all through a series of increasingly complicated action sequences, including what may be the last great analog car chase. Ronin is championed by Mark Slutsky, who's a former film critic turned writer-director. He's made a couple of really great short films, Sorry Rabbi and The Decelerators. He's currently developing his first feature, and I caught him in Toronto making another short. He lives in Montreal, so we don't get to see each other that often. He's an old friend, and it was a pleasure to grab him for a recording session while he was in town. He wanted to talk about Ronin, so here we go. This is someone else's movie. I have a feeling I'm going to be saying this every other week, but this was not a title I would have expected you to pick. Like, I know you fairly well, and Ronin, huh? So what, before we even get into the film, what made you pick this one as a film you wanted to bring back into the world?
Well, Ronin, you know, Ronin is, I think, one of my favorite movies.
Okay.
And yet, when I tell people that, I think they think I'm joking, or they don't really get it, or they don't remember what Ronin is. Or they really get it, because people who love Ronin, I think, are sort of a secret fellowship. Because I think people who love it really love it. Ronin, to me, it's been a movie that's been in my life for, as you know, since it came out. It's a movie I've seen so many times. It's a movie I can remember seeing for the first time really vividly. I saw it at the Lowe's, and then now it's a health club. But at the time, it was a magnificent movie palace called the Lowe's in downtown Montreal. One of those sort of century-old palaces that... at the time that all the, like, new era Paramount, Scotiabank type theaters came in, like, they just shut them all down.
Right.
But, so I just have a really vivid memory of seeing it for the first time and watching it over and over again. And, I even remember when I was, like, living in Paris for a few months, I would go, like, under the bridge and to the steps of Montmartre trying to figure out where the exact locations were. and so, you know, aside from my own personal relationship to this movie, I also think it really is an overlooked movie in a lot of ways. It's probably the last great theatrical film by really one of the more significant American directors of the 20th century. I mean, John Frankenheimer, who had done The Manchurian Candidate, who had done Seconds, who had done a lot of other forgettable stuff, but, you know, in a lot of ways was somewhat of a giant. This was his swan song, and it's such a beautifully executed movie. And yet, I don't think people don't really talk about it. There was a, you know, you can get it now on Blu-ray, but like a really like shamefully stripped down Blu-ray. The director's commentary for this on the DVD is one of my favorite director's commentaries of all time. It's Frankenheimer's really sort of, it's just one of those really specific ones where he talks about all of his choices in like a really great way. And they didn't even bother putting it on the Blu-ray, which just feels like it was just like regurgitated by some home video department. The alternate ending isn't on it, and so I feel like it is an ill-served movie.
Yeah, it's one of those. The Blu-ray was released in that first wave, I think, of catalog titles.
Yeah.
Of like, let's put out a bunch of action movies. Those are the ones that always sell really well. It's a demo picture for your sound system, because the sound mix is really, it's not as complex as I remember it.
Mm-hmm.
Having just watched it again, you know, home theater style, it's enveloping and directional, but it was like, like much of the film, it's really straightforward. The way I think of Ronin and had thought of it for the, 15 years since I'd last seen it, probably, is that it's a really functional, journeyman, workman-like kind of spy movie about spy movies that they don't make anymore. And then I watched it and I'm like, oh, wait, no, I completely missed all the other things that are happening in it.
Yes.
So I still don't think I love it, but I appreciate the crap out of it in a way that I wasn't actually prepared to embrace, I think, based on my last, like, the two viewings I had in 1998 and whenever the special edition DVD came out, which was the last time I would have looked at it, like 1999, 2000, 2001.
Well, I think before we sort of get into the details and the things that I love about it and what I think is so interesting about it, maybe I could just say a few words about the movie.
By all means.
For anyone who hasn't seen it, and because part of my mission here today talking to you is to get people to see this movie. So I want anyone listening to this podcast to be able to sort of follow along, even if you haven't seen it. So Ronin is 1998... I guess you call it an action movie, but one thing I actually want to talk about is how sort of sui generis it is in a lot of ways. It stars Robert De Niro, Jean Reno, Stellan Skarsgård, Natasha McElhone, Sean Bean, and it's about, it's basically about a heist, and it's about Natasha McElhone. It plays a representative of an Irish organization that is basically the provisional IRA.
It's always the provisional.
Right? Yes.
Like in every movie, I'm thinking like Patriot Games where, no, they're a splinter group because we don't actually want to make the IRA angry.
Yeah, but, yeah. Well, it's sort of, from the time it takes place, it sort of makes sense that they're not the IRA because this is around the time of the peace talks, and the whole idea is that...
It factors it in a really kind of interesting, subtle, and almost backdoored sort of way. So much of the film, and this is the thing that doesn't come across in a summary of it, so much of the film is... about intuition and illusion, and just sort of making us, leading us, the characters never speak directly about anything, almost. Mm-hmm. To the point where, and we'll get to this too, there's I have an entire alternate theory for the movie about allegiances and who's doing what to whom, but you will never, there is no scene where we get the details.
No, we never, okay, and then that extends to like the very MacGuffin of the briefcase itself. But
absolutely.
So basically, McElhone, whose name is Deirdre in the movie, she hires this group of aging, basically ex-spies or ex, you know, I don't know what you, I guess spies is the best way to put it.
Mercenaries.
Yeah, now mercenaries.
Default.
Yeah. Ronin, masterless samurai, who consist of Robert De Niro, Jean Reno, Stellan Skarsgård, Sean Bean, to steal a briefcase. And the whole movie is about this briefcase and how they steal it, how they're betrayed, how the betrayers are betrayed themselves. It's basically just a succession of betrayals and double crosses, all based around this mysterious briefcase. And I think that's the best way to describe it. It's very much an action movie. It has some of the, I think, the greatest car chases. I think it's sort of a peak of car chase cinema.
Well, it's the last big practical car chase picture. I mean, unless there's one that I'm not thinking of, for the most part, you'll get something like The Matrix Reloaded, which has that amazing elaborate car chase, but it's digitally augmented.
This is really like late film.
Yeah.
It's a late film movie.
This is analog shit.
Yeah, so absolutely. I don't think there's anything digital in this movie at all. I remember reading about special mounts that Frankenheimer had commissioned so he could put the cameras right under the front bumpers of the cars. Mm-hmm. So you get this really sort of great like point of view stuff in the car chase sequences. So the interesting thing about it is it's a spy movie, it's an action movie, it's a samurai movie in a lot of ways, it's a heist movie, and I know it's not the only movie that sort of overlaps in that way, but I think it's really nice the way it sort of is all those things at once.
Yeah, and there's also the secret weapon, which is David Mamet.
Yes.
Pseudonymous David Mamet.
Yeah, named, I think he used the name Richard Weiss. No, J.D. Zeick actually was the original screenwriter.
J.D. Zeick is a real person?
Yeah, he was an industry newcomer who had never written anything, and as far as I can tell, hasn't written anything since.
Huh.
Mamet came, reports differ, but I think Frankenheimer said that basically the credit should have been story by J.D. Zeick, script by David Mamet. Uh-huh. But no one really knows. But he didn't even, he used a pen name. He used his name Richard Weiss.
Yeah.
And the dialogue is so mad. That's the other thing I have to say about this movie. I mean, there's lines in this movie that I say all the time. You know, everyone wants to go to the party. Nobody wants to clean up. I never walk into a place I don't know how to walk out of. All these great lines. I mean, the dialogue is just fantastic. I could just listen to it all day. I could listen to Jean Reno and Robert De Niro say... world-weary spy stuff back and forth like for hours, and I would still not be satisfied.
And there is something perfect to it. I this would have been a year after The Spanish Prisoner, Mamet's kind of spy movie, which isn't really, but it's a similar take on espionage, and I'm assuming why you got the gig. But The Spanish Prisoner is David Mamet directing David Mamet.
Yes.
So it is almost infuriatingly Mamet-y.
Yes.
Through and through to the point of...
Spartan, you know, if you will.
Spartan. Well, there's a perfect example of what that could be.
As an adjective. But, yeah.
It is his... That is his deal. Like, deny everything to the viewer, deny the audience context, deny the audience relationships, have no dynamics other than the action on the screen. It's a playwright's approach to drama. What you see is the only thing that matters in a moment-to-moment situation. Mm-hmm. But, of course, in a movie, you have to stitch things together, and we have to understand why. And that's where his advantage of just ambiguity comes in. It is possible to go through the film. Mild spoilers will be floated throughout, guys. Really, go pause now, go watch Ronin, then come back. That's the best way to do this. But it is possible, looking at the movie again, that... more than one character is doing the I never left thing. I'm pretty sure two of them are. But there's nothing to disprove it. There's nothing to disprove it because there's nothing to prove it. It's all so completely ambiguous.
What I love is that, you know, okay, so I would also say this is like really the quintessential post-Cold War thriller.
Yep.
But it's, you know, that's a very thin slice if you think of post-Cold War, pre-9/11.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of other films in that genre. None of them really come to mind, but it really is like... because it's set sort of after what in the film is referred to as the late unpleasantness.
Right.
With just these characters sort of wandering around, looking to make money, looking to sort of survive and figure out what their identity is.
They have cell phones, but they're not really good ones. There's that it is 1997, 98.
Yeah, yeah.
Other than that, everything else is just, you know, Czechoslovakia might have just collapsed.
Yeah.
We don't know precisely where we are. And that's part of it, too. Like, everything about it feels 20 years out of date. Everybody feels too old. Everybody feels too slow.
Yeah. Everyone is weary. You never find out specifically what these people used to do. You can tell Stellan Skarsgård is ex-KGB.
Yeah, but he's supposed to be German, so that might not be true.
Yes, it could be Stasi. Yeah.
It's also strangely blurred.
Yeah, yeah. Jean Reno seems to be...
French Secret Service.
De Niro, CIA.
Yeah. Then there's Larry, which everybody forgets about.
Yeah, Skip Suddeth.
Yeah, the only actor who's not a genuine movie star.
Yeah.
Who survives a lot longer than you expect him to.
Totally.
And who is probably just an analyst. Like, there's no sense of who this guy was, but he's competent.
He's the car guy. Yeah.
He's not a failure. He's not washed up. He's just the guy.
Just a professional.
Yeah, like...
And they're all professional. That's what I really like about this movie. They're all just very professional.
Except
for the one who isn't. And the movie really makes a great point of the whole Sean Bean stuff. I just think he's so great in this movie. He's so quintessentially Sean Bean. So nervous.
Yeah.
So much bravado, and it all goes so wrong.
Yeah.
And I think it's so beautiful.
I had not noticed the previous viewings. I really caught it this time, probably just because of the definition of Blu-ray and my memory having faded of the film experience. How sweaty he is.
Yeah.
Like, he is oily
and pale
and over his head right away.
Like,
you know he's wrong. You can feel something off about the guy. And it's a kind of performance that Sean Bean doesn't give anymore, because now he's Sean dies at the end. He's the guy who doesn't make it.
Yeah,
And the fact that he really only factors into the first act of the film and is dealt with so cleanly means that you really need to learn everything about him faster than you learn about the other characters to be able to believe what happens to him and how it works. But just the fact that he's a dick. Like, he's completely out of place in every moment of the film.
Yeah, because everyone else is so, you know, he just stands out because everyone else is so sullen. No one's happy to be there. Yeah.
They're all tired and pissed off.
Yeah,
like, they're all jet lagged or bored.
And there's so many details about how they act that make them feel real and genuine. Like, the fact that she meets them all in a cafe at the beginning. There's all these great little moments of spycraft where you see De Niro hiding the gun behind the cafe. Yeah. It's one of those things. It's like it's an anti-Chekhov's gun. He hides his gun. He never uses it, but it just sort of shows you that he never walks into a place he doesn't know how to walk out of.
Yeah, and of course the payoff to that scene is that he's supposed to immediately surrender it. As soon as he reveals that he's hiding, I had a gun. I knew what I was going to do. It's all fine. It's like, well, now you're going somewhere where you can't have a gun.
Yeah,
yeah, but it's all right. Like, he's just
And she says, "Well, if you never walk into a place you can't walk out of, how come you're getting in this van?" And he's like,
at this point, but that's it. Like, at that point in the movie, you're like 6 minutes into the picture, and you're just like, "Oh, I get this world." Like,
totally.
You know where you are, even if you're not. And that's what's so great about the construction of the film itself. Even the titles, which start with this silly, ostentatious...
I love it.
In the 17th century, Masterless Samurai, they were called Ronin.
which is also the title of the movie.
Yeah.
And it's so old school. Like, yeah. It feels like Bridge on the River Kwai.
Well, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of sort of references, not specific old movies, but just to, you just get a sense of, like, it almost reminds me of Raiders of the Lost Ark in a way that it sort of harkens back to an early era of movies, and it harkens back to the Cold War, and there's all these sort of things that are mentioned casually, characters that you never see, but everyone knows, like the man in the wheelchair, all these, like, really almost like, I don't know how to put it, not cartoonish, but these sort of, like, real stock, almost stock characters, but stock, kind of stock characters you never see anymore. You never see the ominous man in the wheelchair anymore in a movie, but they sort of populate the background of this movie.
Well,
Vienna, there's a reference to, oh, where do I know you from? Oh, Vienna, yes, I remember that. You never find out what that is, but it just sort of creates this sort of, like, faded world behind them.
Yeah, well, it's, I was trying to figure out if it was retro chic or if it was the work of an aging filmmaker who just wants to make another movie like The Train, where everything's on top and the values are all good and evil and there's no confusion about what's happening, even though there might be moral ambiguities to the actions people take. And it felt to me like it's not nostalgic exactly, because nobody's happy. Like, there's no pleasure. Raiders is about glorying in those movies.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Ronin is about, oh, Jesus Christ, they're still doing them. Like, they're still, like, these, not they're still making these movies, but these people are still doing these things. And that's really fascinating. Like, just the idea that, as I was saying, like, I don't know how to do anything else.
Yeah.
And this is that. Like,
And those movie tropes are used not to give you a sense of warm nostalgia, but to give you that sense of what it must like to be these characters who are sort of in this, you know, they're part of a world that's just sort of fading away, and that's sort of a really interesting way to use that sort of ambiguous references to old movies.
Yeah, it's lonely. They're miserable.
Yeah,
it's gray. It's oppressively gray. And I was
it's very unglamorous. Like when they first all meet, Deirdre takes them to this sort of meeting spot, and then they all have a sleepover.
Yeah,
like they'll sleep in these, like, sleeping bags, and then wake up and they sort of share cigarettes. And
but they agree to sleep in shifts, which is great because you're instantly picking the guy who's going to have your back, even though you've never met them before.
Yeah,
there's that weird sense of, which is, again, part of my theory about what Renault's really up to. It's like they're the two that bond immediately. It's
right.
Like, are you both on the job? Is this something else going on?
Yeah.
And it's, nothing disproves it.
Yeah, that's true.
Or maybe it's just, you know, he's 20 years older and he's looking like the son he never had or some other kind of...
I feel like with their relationship, which I think is so great, I feel like it's De Niro, who I love in this movie. I love the way he looks around. I love the way he's always aware of his surroundings. I love the way he's always skeptical. You always see him thinking, calculating.
He's the proto-born.
Yeah, he is sort of.
He's the old Jason Bourne.
Like, yeah, this is, exactly.
If Matt Damon lives long enough in the Bourne movies,
it's in his bones.
Yeah.
And I feel like he's just looking for someone to trust, or looking for someone competent, looking for someone he can stand next to who won't get him killed.
He responds to confidence, and he responds to people who are... The scene he has with Michelle Lonsdale.
Yeah.
Is just like two old pros. That's the movie. That's the scene in Unknown where Bruno Ganz and Frank Langella have a cigarette together,
right?
And nothing happens, but they're just like quietly discussing. Oh, remember when?
You don't know anything about Lonsdale's character except for he lives in this old chateau, and that he has some pull. He's able to, like, figure some things out for Jean Reno. But you know he's an old spy master.
Yeah,
and maybe it's because you remember him from Day of the Jackal. Maybe it's you know, it's sort of those, like, subtle references that aren't even references to old movies, but they're just sort of part of, like, the ambience of the film.
I'm convinced that Spielberg cast him in that role in Munich because he'd done it in Ronin.
Right,
even though
it
takes place 20 years earlier.
Right.
It's the same, that sort of continuum, that continuity is there. He's a guy he looks like the guy who you would go to. Like, there's an iconography at work that is,
really, he's sort of sad and trustworthy, and you know he's probably done a few things that broke his own heart.
And really specific about it.
Yeah.
You can just tell, like, the loneliness of a man who paints little figures and just...
And who's half convinced De Niro's going to kill him before the scene is over.
Yeah.
He's sort of like, he's not doing anything about it. He's just sort of like, De Niro has to keep reassuring him that he's not going to kill him, which happens a couple times in the movie when, like, they're... and I want to talk about this whole sequence where the gun buy that goes wrong, where De Niro says, you go ahead, or I've got your back, and no. Jean Reno says, you know, I've got your back, and De Niro kind of looks at him just for a second, and Jean Reno goes, "What would I profit from your death?"
Yes, I already have the money.
Yeah, it's like, I get it. I know why you're worried. I'm not offended. There's nothing personal, but I'm not going to profit from this. So go ahead.
Yeah, and that's the one thing people do explain to each other is that you can trust me.
Yeah, yeah.
Or that you can trust me now, like right this second, it's going to be fine.
And that's the moment where they bond in the movie. Like, that's the moment where they really sort of click. And I really... So there's this one of the first action and then chase sequences in the movie is a gun buy underneath a bridge in Paris. And when I was in Paris, I used to look for that bridge all the time, look for that exact location. And I really love that scene. It's sort of a gun buy that goes bad, turns into a shootout, and then a chase. Sean Bean's character's complete lack of experience becomes very evident. But what I love about that scene is it's such a great use of location. So they go under this bridge. They're trying to exchange money for guns. Everyone knows something is wrong.
Deeply atmospheric.
Very atmospheric.
Sodium lighting on the Champs-Élysées.
Yeah, exactly. And De Niro knows something's up, and he says, they might have a sniper up there, but they can't see him. But then the sniper is revealed by the lights of the bateau mouche, which are these boats that, if you've ever been to Paris, are always going up and down the Seine. And the fact that it's like the bateau mouche boat light that reveals a sniper, it's perfect location use. That's a scene that could only happen in that one place, in that one city, and play out exactly like that. And that's what makes it so great. That's what makes it so immersive. I love that it's not in a factory, it's not in some like soundstage. It's there in that place, in the real world, in a real city, and happens that way because it's there. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just a really, really great filmmaker, at his best, making those decisions.
Yeah, there is, the location work is remarkable. Again, everything is tactile, everything is real. Even a scene in a skating rink with, 2,000 people?
Yeah.
Those are real people in a real rink.
Watching a real skater, Katerina Witt.
Yeah. Just strangely stops the movie in a weird way, that's happening, because, you have this, there's this strange sense that even when the stakes are incredibly high and the fate of the free world hangs in the balance, if this one thing doesn't happen as planned, you still have a sense of beauty. You still have a sense of this momentary grace that everyone is distracted by. You're looking at it on monitors, or they're sort of paying attention to it from the wings. But it's like the real world is going on around all this clandestine stuff, which is why the bystander count is so high, which is kind of creepy.
Yeah, it's actually something I really appreciate about this movie is that it doesn't pretend that in a car chase shootout on the streets of a French village that people wouldn't get hurt.
Yeah,
and
they get hurt badly.
Yeah, like you see people really go down, in the Colosseum chase.
People gunned down outside that little fruit market at the very
beginning. Yeah,
there's no the sense of immediate danger is there, but I think the first time you're confronted with civilian casualties, it's really shocking.
Yeah, it is.
And it never stops being shocking, because there's constant, like the car crashes are really quite visceral. Like, people are dying by the score.
Yeah.
In that midsection.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's that crazy car chase and the wrong way car chase where it's like, people, and I appreciate about that movie. And I don't think it does it in a cruel or mocking way. I think it's sort of like this is what you want. Like, this is the price that's going to have to be paid. Like, don't pretend when you're watching an action movie that, Man of Steel style, that they can destroy Manhattan by punching each other and no one's going to get hurt. I think that's quite, and I think that's also part of the world weary, I wouldn't say cynicism of the movie, but that sense of like, there's sort of an unromantic sense to it. But it's romantic at the same time in a weird way.
Yeah, it really is. It's
a weird, almost kind of a bit of a Casablanca vibe, I find, from this movie. And just like, you have these sort of stock characters, and you kind of know who they are. And they're all meeting in these sort of marginal spaces, like that are like in these sort of weird no man's lands, and they all have their business, and I don't know. And there's a little bit of humanity that sort of filters in, and that's where the story is.
The principal relationship is not between, although they sort of tease an assignation between De Niro and McElhone. That's not where it goes.
I love that though. I love that. Basically, there's just one scene where they sort of have to do that classic movie thing of pretending to make out. So that the cops don't suspect them.
Right.
But then she sort of like straddles them afterwards. Whatever happens, and then it's like, they're just getting a little bit of pleasure in between all the shit they have to do.
Yeah, it's never mentioned again.
It's very adult, very like, I don't know, it just feels like this is what two professionals would do. They wouldn't be romantic about it. They wouldn't get, it wouldn't turn into a big love story. It's just sort of, they have five minutes and they're attracted to each other.
Yeah, it's weird to see it in that context too of the action movie pause. Because there's kind of a major longueur in the end of the first act, I suppose, where they're casing everything and just going through those motions, which is the stuff that we get now, it would just be montaged into nothing.
Yeah.
But we really do, like, there's that great scene in Cannes where they just go to the Hotel Majestic and take pictures of
yes.
the entourage.
Yes, really reminded me of Grand Budapest Hotel.
It's really bizarre now. Like, it reads yeah. very strangely.
Which is not a movie I thought I would think of watching this movie.
Yeah,
but it's just, I love all those little moments of spycraft where you just see, okay, this is what he would do. He would put the gun here, or he would put the, you know, the sign against the luggage, so when someone pulled it out, you know, it's just yeah. it's great. You're watching, you're like, ah, yes,
yeah,
it's somewhat, you know, this guy's, you know, you know that this guy is experienced, he's smart, he's clever, and it delights you to watch that stuff.
Yeah, and there's no exposition to, like, there's now there would be like I'm thinking like TJ Miller in a Transformers movie going, why is he doing that?
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
this is because he is a professional, let him do his
yeah
work.
Yeah,
none of that. There are only professionals in the film or civilians. And they never interact. Like, they just, there's no moment where someone says, hey, what's going on?
Yeah.
There's that little exchange towards the end where you get the sense of tears of professionalism. The bit in the arena where Renault can't bring himself to knock out a Frenchman.
Yeah, exactly. You
know, he actually says, I could not live with
yeah.
myself.
Yeah, exactly.
And he lets De Niro do it. And then later there's somebody else, he just takes him out
yeah.
for seconds. He's just not on the same level. Like,
yeah.
there are levels of professionalism and levels of appreciation. You get the sense these are guys who tip really well, but they think about how they're tipping.
Right.
Like, every piece of the world feels
yeah.
lived in a way that gets more interesting the further away you go. Like, when the movie is over, you don't think about the plot. You think about, oh, well, I guess that was a pretty interesting way to handle that one thing.
Yeah, it was. I mean, the movie is really just about people who want to get their hands on a specific object.
Mm-hmm.
And it just gets further and further away from them, or they get closer to it and they get further away from it. It's such a great MacGuffin, and such a MacGuffin-y MacGuffin, if
yeah.
that makes any sense. Because the whole, the whole point is that they want to get this briefcase, and that no one knows what's in it. Or maybe someone knows what's in it. Deirdre knows, or probably knows.
You
don't know necessarily that she knows.
It's above our pay.
She wants it. Yeah, exactly. The Russians want it. It's sort of the other great 90s mysterious briefcase,
yeah.
besides the Pulp Fiction one.
Well, when I was on Usenet in the late 90s, because I was, you know, living alone and bored, and the internet was relatively new, and there were conversations about, on Rekart's Current Films Movies, I think, about, you know, like, what's in the briefcase in Ronin? And I would answer and just say, two lights and a battery.
Yeah. yeah.
Sam
yeah,
Jackson's
yeah.
answer for Pulp Fiction, because it doesn't really fucking matter.
Yeah.
Like, it's...
But it hangs a lantern on that so beautifully when, you know, like, De Niro's always asking, what's in the case? Is
yeah.
it a handcuff to some unlucky guy? Is there a bomb in it? Is it heavy? What's
yeah.
in the case?
And
just
the... And they're all valid questions. Like,
yeah.
Those are the questions... They're not the questions that the audience would ask. The question we ask is, what's in the case? But the questions he asks are always in a context where you actually... That's a reasonable question to ask in this situation.
Yeah, exactly. He needs to know that because he needs to know if it's going to blow up or if it's going to be, you know, hard to carry. Or he just... That's... You know, all those early meeting scenes are so great for that. Especially the way he reveals Sean Bean.
Yeah.
Which tells you everything about Sean Bean and everything about De Niro in that one scene. You know, the what color was the boathouse at Hereford. I won't spoil the scene, but... it's one of the many great uses of coffee in this movie.
Yes, coffee.
One thing I love about this movie is that everyone's always sipping coffee. Everyone's always got an espresso, whether it's their metal, like their tin cups that they drink out of early in the movie, or just like them waiting around in Nice or in... what's the name of the other town they're in? The other town in the south of France with the arena. Anyways,
oh.
The point is that everyone's always sipping coffee in this movie, and I love that about it. It's a great
yeah.
coffee movie.
Well, Kate, for listeners who don't know who I am, my wife Kate, said that the thing about the girl with the dragon tattoo drove her insane because so much of it is detailed explanations of what type of coffee and how they make it
right.
constantly. And she said Ronin was the first film she'd seen where she got the same Jones, where we were watching it too late in the day, and it's like, God damn it, I would like a coffee right now.
Yeah.
Oh, and right now. Oh, and right
yeah.
now.
Yeah. And you get the sense that these are people who like really just live on coffee
yeah.
all the time. And the fact that it's used also as a prop in a really inventive way is I think just amazing. Just
yeah.
makes it one of the all time great coffee movies.
And there is the sense too that, you know, you would need to be awake for hours and hours and hours and hours. Like, they're using it as not
yes.
just as a prop, but as a legitimate stimulus.
Yeah, there's a lot of bored waiting that goes on as a spy.
There's even a scene, I think it was the first time I'd ever seen anything like it, where someone says, this isn't going to be today, you guys knock off, it's fine.
Right.
Like, oh yeah, that's right, that's what professionals would do. You would
yeah.
go get dinner.
Yeah, he comes in with a crate of, like, bottles of wine and, like, ham and stuff, and
yeah.
They're just sort of hanging out.
Yeah.
And yeah, I love that.
For a film in which no one discusses their private life or personal history, it's a really human movie. Like, it's a really warm film in a weird way, because the world it creates is so cold that we start to focus more and more, focus more and more on the bond between De Niro and Renault as it starts to form. And it is, in the end, it's a really sweet relationship between these two professionals who are, you know, like, it's not...
It ends with a coffee date.
Yeah. It's not
like,
Mr. White.
They didn't have to meet, but they sort of have a coffee date at the end, I think, just to say goodbye and thank you.
And he does the whole, she would not come.
Yeah, exactly.
That Casablanca ending, which, of course, if you see the extended ending, you know there's a little extra thing to that, which I get why they cut it. It's not important in that moment.
No, it's sort of a sour note to end the movie on, in a way.
Yeah.
It's sort of, it's believable, but it's sort of a sour note. You kind of don't want it to end that way, necessarily.
Yeah, I can see that.
You want them to just sort of drift away the same way they sort of drifted into the movie. You don't know their past. You don't know their future. Yeah. You don't want to know that one of them is going to get picked up by the IRA.
Yeah. People who leave should just leave.
Yeah, just walk away.
Yeah, I remember watching, that was the first thing I watched when I got the DVD back in 99, I guess. And my reaction was like, aw.
Yeah.
That's unnecessary.
It's just because you don't want to imagine what happens next.
Yeah, the movie has been cynical enough to that point.
Yeah.
I think that you don't need to pile on.
I think movies should end in a way that you want to imagine what happens next, not that you want to actively block out thinking about what happens next.
Right. So the question that I ask everybody about the film that they've recommended is, personally, how have you, have you used part of it? Has it inspired you? Is it part of your toolbox in some way? Is there anything from Ronin that you have used or want to use?
I think about it a lot. It's so woven in with my life that it's hard to say specifically what I've taken from it, because I quote it like every other day.
Right.
But one thing I think is really neat about this movie is it's the way it's sort of really shot in wide angle, really sharp, deep focus. That's not a way I really tend to shoot things, but it's a really interesting, it doesn't have a flashy visual style, but it has a really distinct one if you kind of just look at it closely.
Yeah.
Frankenheimer talks a lot about that on the commentary, actually. He said he wanted sort of a documentary style, which is interesting because it doesn't feel like a documentary to me at all, but it's got this sort of detachment to it that is really nice. And I think it's a really good use of picture and image in a way that is not flashy, but just absolutely serves the story. And I think that's really the biggest question when you're making movies: what style do I develop or use to tell the story the best way? And I think it's a movie that really solved that in a really interesting way. So in that way, it's really quite inspiring.
So an aesthetic that defines,
the
narrative defines,
and not an aesthetic that I would want to necessarily crib from myself, but just the way it sort of meshes so well with the story is inspiring.
Yeah, I watched it and thought, I felt a really profound regret that Robert De Niro isn't doing that anymore.
Yeah, I mean,
that level of...
This is I would say this is the last great pre-analyze this era performance.
Yeah, and he absolutely suits the vibe. That's another extension of the aesthetic, I guess. But he is exactly who you would want in that role, in that moment. You get the sense he's... And, of course, he's an actor who comes with a massive history of his own, but... It makes it easier for him to allude to a history. It makes him easier to allude to a level of professionalism.
I think you could compare it to his Jimmy Conway. Is that what his name is in Goodfellas? Because both of these characters who are really observant, who are sort of taciturn, who are very dangerous and have a ton of history, but who are sort of not courtly, but there's no. Unlike Sean Bean, who's brash and swaggering, he has no need to be that way. He's just simple, to the point. You don't want to get in his way, but he's not looking for trouble either. That's what I really like about his character. He's smart. It's really it's a performance. He projects intelligence in this movie in a really interesting way.
Yeah, it's a watchfulness too. The sense that he is.
You trust him, absolutely. You trust that he's going to see any danger, that he's going to be. I don't know. You almost feel you're happy to be along for the ride with that character.
Yeah, and it's the kind of film that really, again, as you say, at the end you could wander off and follow them into another movie. But I'm kind of glad they didn't try. I have no idea why they didn't try, because
it's a pretty successful movie at the time, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was well received. It made money. It sold like crazy. DVD was fairly new, and people really responded to anything that looked and sounded pretty.
Yeah. I think it's a kind of perfect storm situation. Was where else would you get, an aging lion like John Frankenheimer, making one of his final movies, with David Mamet on board, Robert De Niro, Jean Renault? It's such a crazy combination of talents that it sort of feels like it's sort of lightning striking that they all got together the same time.
I mean, my God, if you look at the other things too, the stuff they were coming from, you know, Renault, it's a bad example because he was making movies in France, but his another American movie that year was Godzilla.
Right.
Which nobody talks about, even now. And
I'd like to see someone try and defend that on this.
Someone will, just to be perverse. And Frankenheimer, of course, was coming off The Island of Dr. Moreau, which is, again, back in the news now as a terrible movie because of this documentary that's been made about it.
Oh, really?
Lost Souls.
Oh, wow.
Richard Stanley has finally got his day to tell his story.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm dying to see it.
I'd love to see that. And then he would go into Ranger Games, which is like, you know, I was excited about during the production of it, because I was like, he's making another heist movie.
Everybody was. That was one of those, like, one of those instant Miramax projects where we have Affleck from Good Will Hunting, let's put him in everything. So they got Phantoms. I love Phantoms. and then Ranger Games. Ranger Games is Affleck and Frankenheimer and Gary Sinise and Charlize Theron.
Yeah.
It should be watchable.
It's really unfortunate that it's not. Yeah. It's really unfortunate.
But it's one of those things where I think the only reason it's more disappointing as a venture is because of Frankenheimer's attachment, because Ronan is, like, if nothing else, it's professional. It's a well-made movie.
Yeah. I mean, Frankenheimer in a lot of ways is sort of like one of the characters in that film. He's a aging professional with, like, you know, an unbelievable amount of experience under his belt, probably a lot of good and bad stories.
Yeah. Oh, clearly. I mean, just look at his filmography.
Yeah.
He worked with not everybody, but most everybody. Although, he spent a lot of time in the wilderness in the 70s and the 80s.
Yeah. A ton of early TV. But Manchurian Candidate is, you know, you could really, you know, that's one of the big ones.
Yeah.
You know, Seconds, which is, like, I think being rediscovered in a nice way in the last few years, which is also a fantastic movie.
Yeah.
French Connection 2, interestingly enough.
Yeah.
Which is sort of a Ronin type of movie, in a way.
It's not a bad film, it's just not the French Connection, which is a problem. Like, to be that... I think Frankenheimer and Boorman had that struggle in the 70s where people were giving them franchise properties before franchises were franchises.
Right, right.
No one knew what... You know, just make it again, do it again. And he can't, because that's not who he is. So he goes off and makes... The movie he makes, which has characters like Papa Doyle gets addicted to heroin and you have to suffer through this. And it's like, this is, okay, I get the gritty realism, but it's not what you want from that property.
Yeah, but it's funny, you could almost take Frankenheimer's early movies and just sort of take parts from them and put them together and then they would become Ronin. Like, The French Connection would not be a bad name for Ronin if there hadn't already been a movie like that. But you could take... stuff from that. You could take
the
Cold War stuff from Manchurian Candidate.
Exactly what I was going to say. There are elements of the Manchurian Candidate.
Grand Prix, The Train. I mean, like, all that's, you know, it makes so much sense in retrospect that he would make Ronin.
Yeah, it is. It's one of those things where apotheosis. All the paths lead to this thing, which then doesn't fully engage with its own history. Like, for everyone, as we've discussed, and I don't want to turn this into a circular loop where we go back over the same, that was awesome because points.
Right.
Like, that's going to happen a lot on this show, I fear.
I would be happy to go over any points in this movie and talk about how awesome they were.
Well, let's talk about Stellan Skarsgård briefly, because I just happened, the night before Ronan, two nights before, one or the other of us, Kate or me, had mentioned The Hunt for Red October on Twitter, which the rule is... that we have to watch The Hunt for Red October again.
Just watched it again recently.
So we just got the back-to-back baby-faced Stellan Skarsgård performance.
And he's really great in this movie. He's sort of in the background at the very beginning, but then they introduce him so well by having... Well, he's actually the first person that Robert De Niro tests with a tin cup.
Yeah. Passes.
Yeah, and
just
exactly.
Proficiency.
And he's just testing him. He catches it. Reflexes. Yeah. They die hard.
Yeah.
I mean, he's just like, there's menace just sort of coiling off of him like steam.
Mm-hmm.
And you know he's going to do something bad.
Yeah.
But you have no idea what it is or what he wants.
And it's that leftover Eastern.
And he looks like a nerd. I mean, he just looks like this. He looks like an IT guy.
Yeah, he's not a good fighter. Like, throughout the revelations about his character, we learn a few things. And it's clearly he was in intelligence.
Yeah.
He's clever. He's wily.
He's willing to shoot children.
But he gets beaten up a lot.
Yeah.
So he's not good at everything, which is great for a villain, or for a heavy, because he's not the ultimate villain. But you get the sense that this is a guy who's taking his shot. Like, this is his chance to do his one.
But he's been observing, you know. He's an observer, like De Niro. It's an interesting...
opposite number.
Yeah, like, I feel like a lot of the characters in this movie are observers. They're watchers who are waiting for the right moment. Which is kind of an interesting characteristic for a movie hero, you know, to hold back and watch rather than to jump into the fight. I mean, that's what Sean Bean is almost like the...
He tries to establish dominance. He tries to be the natural leader, and he's just not good.
Yeah, I mean, when he throws up after the car chase because he's too excited. I mean, it's such a great, humiliating detail.
Yeah, and he's like, even his response immediately after the playing the adrenaline rush that fades.
Yeah, where he's like, really... got the swag, got the money, sort of rocking back and forth. And you're like, oh, dude, you are like so out of place here.
It's like your team just won. Like, he looks like he's rooting for somebody. Like the worst kind of football yabo you can imagine. And that's the guy you're stuck in a car with, and he has a gun.
So yeah.
There's tension. He's obviously to be laughed at that point, but it's still unnerving, because if he does, like, if he overreacts, everybody dies. It's one of those really kind of tiny calibrations of performance where if it goes the wrong way, he stands out too much. If it goes, like, too far up or too far down, he's tuned it exactly.
Yeah, like, just the way he says, let's just do it and be done. Let's just do it and be done. It's, it's the perfect manifestation of bravado and of, like, a guy who just is in over his head and just wants this to be over.
Yeah. I kind of want to follow his character, because he just leaves.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing. He doesn't come back.
But he also doesn't get killed.
Yeah.
That's a crazy thing about that character. I'm always like, why did they kill him?
Yeah. You would kind of want to. But I think even the idea, well, the way they do handle it is, here's your money, fuck off.
Yeah. And just, like, go forget away. About us, because we won't forget about you.
Yeah. That level of threat, I mean, it would work on someone who's out of his depth. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, this guy's probably... I just want to catch up with him now and find out he's got, like, 7 or 8 other stories that...
Yeah.
Like, this other thing he was on that didn't pan out. And you just know an hour after this movie, he's in a pub somewhere going, oh, you know, the IRA...
They're talking trash about it.
That was me. I did that.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
I had this running gag when I was younger. If I was ever late for anything, I would apologize by saying, well, you know, the Queen can sleep soundly tonight. Sorry, it's been 20 minutes, but everything's fine. And he's that guy.
Yeah.
He just hasn't learned not to do that. It's a really recognizable kind of swagger of the false action.
And he always brings a bit of that to his roles. I mean, like Boromir in Lord of the Rings is like the...
Aww,
he's like the would-be hero who doesn't quite have it, you know?
Poor Boromir. And Ned Stark. These guys are just like...
Yeah, exactly. Like, these guys who are almost heroes. That's just like weirdly his thing, for different reasons too.
Yeah.
Ned Stark is just too straight. He's just too
the rules
too honest.
The rules will save you. No, they won't.
Yeah.
And I've actually...
Boromir's just a bit too weak, you know? If he was a bit stronger, he might be the hero.
Tiny miscalculations. But he looks the part. Like, you want him to figure he's going to make this. This time it's going to work out for Sean Bean.
Yeah.
I've interviewed directors who have said they've toyed with casting him just so they can almost endanger the character repeatedly. Like, he would plug something in on a wet floor.
Right.
And just because the audience is waiting for it now. But that level of self-awareness is, like, it's starting to creep into his performances, which I really admire. Like,
mm-hmm.
He's having fun with being the guy who doesn't make it.
Yeah.
And in a weird way,
it actually takes a lot of strength to be that guy and not, I think, as an actor, to not need to be the hero.
Yeah. And in this case, he's not, like, this is almost an audition for that kind of role, where it's just like, you know what? I'll be interesting and I'll go. I'm not going to kick and scream and I'm not going to make trouble for anybody, but I'm going to suck up a little eyeball action while I'm in here. You're going to pay attention to me.
And just the way he sort of wilts when he's discovered and just, you know,
just goes
slumps
out
away.
Yeah. He's just a loser now.
Yeah.
You can just, and it was there all along, which is why the film rewards second viewings. In a way that most action movies don't, because with an action movie, you're there for the thrill of it, and then later you go back and maybe you appreciate the craft.
Yeah.
There's a handful of movies. Die Hard is the one I always come back to. It's like every time I watch it, I just, wow, they handled that one thing beautifully.
Sure, they set up exactly who this character is, and the fact that he's going to have to, like, take off his shoes in another room in the first, you know, 30 seconds of the movie.
Yeah, and it's all so beautifully placed. With Ronan, I found myself actually focusing on character relationships in a weird way. I
mean, well, just the way he asks De Niro, like, what kind of weapons do you like?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Come on, like, I'm like you. I'm like
45? Served my country well. You know, that all that stuff, like, De Niro's just instant disdain for him. It's so great.
It's true.
He pegs him as a fake, like, instantly. And he just sort of waits for his moment to show everyone else. Like, it's great.
Yeah. The undersung Sean Bean. The invaluable unsung Sean Bean.
I think he is, you know, I think Sean Bean's finally getting, I think thanks to Game of Thrones, which is kind of ironic. And I guess, you know, I had read Game of Thrones before I saw the first season, so I knew what was coming.
Right.
But I think even if I hadn't, I'd like to think I would have maybe suspected just because it was Sean Bean.
Right. Well, now it's sort of an obligation.
Yeah.
So, yes, if anybody does want to make a movie where Sean Bean trips and falls down several flights of stairs over the course of the movie, that would be a great runner.
But ultimately lives.
And it's always fine. Yeah. Or he shows up with a cast, like a bandaged figure. It's fine. Like the end of Lady and the Tramp when Jock and Trusty come back. It's like, oh, he didn't die.
Right.
Spoilers for Lady and the Tramp. Sorry. Yeah, it's the kind of performance that no one talks about simply because he disappears.
Yeah.
And it's what James Cameron always talks about, the recency effect. Like, it doesn't matter what you do in your movie, the last 20 minutes are the things people remember.
Yeah.
And he's the first. So he just sort of fades away, but he's really good.
And it's quite clever because he's not the first to die in the movie, but he sort of fulfills that function of the first man down.
Yeah.
In a way. But yeah, so, I mean, Ronin, I think if you've made it this far, you've probably seen Ronin. but if we managed to sustain your interest and you haven't, I really recommend it. It's such a pleasure to watch. Watching it again, just to review it before we recorded this, I couldn't help thinking that I just really made the right choice. I was so happy to be watching it again.
Was there anything else you considered?
You know, I considered this, like, I considered some movies that are... Like, there's this movie that I love, this Argentinian movie from about 5 years ago called Historias Extraordinarias.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite movies of the last 10 years. I think now, especially since there's a movie out called Wild Tales, which is almost the same title, but it's also Argentinian, I think this is a movie I'd really like people to rediscover. But I don't think it's right for this specific podcast and for the kind of conversation that I wanted to have here.
I'm also trying
I'd like to champion that movie in another venue, but...
Is it available? Is it on disc?
I don't even think it's available. Released? I think you can download it from some, you know, semi-shady, artsy download sites. But, you know, another... You know, I would like to talk about... a movie that I don't think has many defenders besides myself, which is Hostel 2 by Eli Roth.
And I did mention this.
I would love to come back and talk about that movie because I think it is, well, I'll talk about this if you ever have me back, but I think it's unfairly, I think both those movies are unfairly maligned, and I think they're lumped in with a whole genre of movies that they don't quite belong with, and I think they're more interesting than people give them credit for.
I don't know that I can malign Hostel 2 enough, so we may have to.
This would be a great. We have to have a conversation where we disagree for sure.
Okay, well, we'll put that on the list of repeat episodes.
Yeah,
and until then, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at @totallyslutsky. You can find me at markslutsky.com. Which is my website.
And the short film you made, The Decelerators, which is on Vimeo?
You can find it on Vimeo despite Googling The Decelerators, Vimeo, Mark Slutsky. Find it linked from my site.
You should absolutely do this, by the way. It's a great short.
Thank you. And my other weird life project is a site called Sad YouTube, where I find and preserve sad and heartbreaking comments from YouTube's, speaking of unfairly maligned things, the YouTube comment section.
It is quite fascinating. And you did an audio documentary for...
Yeah, recently I did an audio documentary about it for CBC, which you can find on the CBC Day 6 website, where I found some commenters who had some really interesting stories. One about her sister, whose murder still hasn't been solved. And I actually tracked down these people and talked to them and interviewed them, and then talked to Bobby Goldsboro, the musician whose song they left their comments on, and sort of played them for each other. And it was really, really quite interesting. And you may cry when you hear this audio documentary.
Yeah. But yeah, so thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me. This was delightful.
Anytime. Well, Hostel 2 time. We'll get there. And there we go. My thanks again to my guest, Mark Slutsky. As he said, you can find him on Twitter at @totallyslutsky and by Googling Sad YouTube, which you really should do. You should also chase down The Decelerators when you have a chance. It's like 5 minutes long. It's really something, and I would say that even if Mark wasn't an old friend. As always, you can find me at Norm Wilner on Twitter. Elsewhere on the internet, I'm at nowtoronto.com, where I write about movies more or less constantly. You can also follow this podcast at Semcast on Twitter, SEMcast, or on the interwebs at www.someoneelsesmovie.com. This is the third episode down. I feel really confident, and you know what? We'll be a little bit better next time. Thanks again for listening. Oh, and leave a review on iTunes if you're interested in that kind of thing, because right now there aren't any, and the podcast looks lonely. Thanks a lot, guys. See you next time.
I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.